lot of Christians about who think that the doctrine of the Trinity is quite peripheral and dispensable. My opinion is that it is neither, that it is an essential article of faith, and I would go so far as to say that Christians are Trinitarians and non-Trinitarians are not Christians. The resurrection of the dead is also seen by a number of people as quite dispensable, quite peripheral. After all, who knows what's going to happen out there anyway? No one has been there and come back except Jesus, and the record of that is all tied up with the church's commitments and all kinds of things, and so let's not say too much about it. As far as I'm concerned, the doctrine of the resurrection is absolutely essential to the faith, and I should say that to deny the resurrection of the dead is really to deny the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Paul said that before I did in 1 Corinthians 15, and that if we deny the resurrection of the dead, we are still in our sins and our faith is futile, and we are of all men most to be pitied, because we're living on an illusion and we're misrepresenting God and we're misrepresenting reality. Today we talk about original sin, and I think the same kind of thing is true. Particularly with that word original, there are a lot of people in the church for whom the doctrine of original sin is a kind of a stumbling block. It's something that people think to be quite unnecessary, quite dispensable. And again, I'm going to try to make a pitch for it and to say that the doctrine of original sin is of immense importance for the Christian faith, and that it bears looking at and it bears affirming. It's necessary, I think, again, to repeat something about the nature of church doctrine or theology, just so that we understand what it is that we're doing. And one important thing to say, it seems to me, about doctrine is that doctrine has a history. Doctrine is not revealed. Jesus Christ is revealed, but doctrine is not revealed. Doctrine is man-made. That is not to say that God isn't involved in the process of making doctrine. But doctrine does not come fresh from God. It doesn't fall from the sky. Doctrine is man-made. Doctrine is a human formulation which attempts to gather up the data of revelation. And so when one talks about the doctrine of sin, then one has to pick it up at various places. There's a book in the library by Daniel Day Williams entitled The Spirit and the Forms of Love. And one of the great sentences in that book is that love has a history. You simply cannot talk about Christian doctrine without talking about its historical development. The word love means nothing until you start to talk about its development. And it's been talked about at different ways, at different times in different ways. That's also true of sin. So that when we talk about sin, somehow or another, we have to talk about Paul, because he got involved in that. We have to talk about Augustine, because Augustine laid out in classic form the church's talk about sin. We have to talk about the Reformation, because again, at the time of the Reformation, the doctrine of sin became central. You have to talk about the social gospel movement, because at the time of the social gospel movement, the doctrine of sin, again, became central to the church's talk. So doctrine is historical. That's one thing that it's important to say. Another thing is that doctrine is descriptive of a reality. It is not the reality itself. The doctrine of the Trinity is the church's talk about how to make some kind of sense of biblical data about God and Jesus and Spirit. The doctrine of the Trinity isn't the triune God. You don't say, do you believe in the doctrine of the Trinity? No, of course I don't believe in the doctrine of the Trinity. I believe in the triune God, about
whom the doctrine of the Trinity talks. Okay? So, it's just like saying that the High Renaissance period, Rich said last night, I think lasted 13 years. Now that is a way of gathering up some data. The High Renaissance period doesn't exist except in someone's mind. What exists is X number of paintings and people and sculptors and buildings. Or he says last night, I can say all these things because you're here to defend yourself and correct yourself. I'd say them even if you weren't. This is a piece of classical art. That's a generalization. That's a category that's imposed on X number of things. Classical art doesn't exist as a thing anywhere except in the historian's mind, and when you get enough people who study the data and who see certain similarities and groupings, they decide among one another, gee, it would make sense to group these things under the word classical. And they say, all right, now this is classical. And so it's absolutely absurd, it seems to me, to say, don't generalize. Of course, we have to generalize. Or don't categorize. Don't put things into categories. That is absolutely essential to human life. I meet a man here who comes in on the bus, and I look at him. I've never seen him before. There is no other person on God's earth that is exactly who he is. But I look at him and I say, he's a man, he's not a dog. The reason I can do that is because I've looked at a lot of men and a lot of dogs, and I've drawn certain generalizations. I have some categories with which to work, and so I can look at him and I can say with a very, very high degree of probability, this is a man and that's not a dog, and he's not a dog. All right? So the problem is not generalizing or categorizing. The problem is when we don't know what it is that we're doing when we generalize or categorize. And then we get in trouble. Doctrines are generalizations. Doctrines are categorizations. I read an article yesterday by Isaac Asimov on the ultimate speed. And he talked about the ultimate speed is 186,000 miles a second, which is the speed of light. That goes back to Einstein's theory of relativity, and it goes back to mass and velocity. And as velocity increases, kinetic energy increases, and mass increases, and 186,000 miles a second is that speed at which mass becomes infinite and can no longer be pushed or accelerated, and so it is impossible to conceive of anything moving faster than 186,000 miles a second. Then Asimov says, of course, this is only theory. But no thing has ever been measured as going faster than 186,000 miles, and very likely nothing ever will be measured as going faster than 186,000 miles a second. And so the fact that it's only theory doesn't mean that it's insignificant. The fact that something is only a generalization doesn't mean that it's unimportant. Doctrines are generalizations. They're categories, but they're desperately important because they are ways of gathering up data. So the doctrine of original sin is not sin. It's not God. It's a doctrine, and yet it's terribly significant because it is one of the ways in which the church attempts to protect its proclamation. I should say particularly about the business of sin that I would have a very hard time moving from experience to this particular doctrine.
I confess to you that I do not have a very good built-in guilt machine. Now, I don't know for how many of you that's true. I feel bad about things. I make all kinds of mistakes. I violate people. I misuse opportunities. I do all kinds of bad things. But I think, were I not a Christian, that I could handle those things psychologically without bringing them to God. Maybe you'll want to press me on that later. I would hate to be misunderstood on that. But that's just who I am. And if I had to build up the church's doctrine of sin, the church's doctrine of original sin, out of my own experience, I don't think I'd ever make it. But as a Christian, I don't build doctrine out of my own gut. The data with which I work is the data found in the Scriptures, the apostolic witness to Jesus Christ, and the life of the community of the faithful, which has lived in and fussed with for 2,000 years that apostolic witness. And when I begin there and go to the doctrine of original sin, and then I discover what the church has meant by that generalization, by that category, by that doctrine, then I discover that my experience is illuminated in a way that I cannot imagine could be illuminated apart from that particular doctrine. So that's another thing about doctrine. I think we're always running a hazard if we try to move from experience to the Scriptures. It seems to me the direction is rather the other way around. I know Jesus Christ. I believe in him. I turn my life over to him. Where do I find them? Not in the trees, not in my gut, not in my conscience, but in the Scriptures. I go to the Scriptures, and there I find data that the church has worked with, put together in various ways. The doctrine of original sin is one of those ways. I listen to it. I try to understand what the church has said by that, and I discover, gee, that's the way it really is. So it winds up illuminating my experience, but it does not begin with experience. Okay, the forgiveness of sins, that's another thing to say, I suppose, is that when we talked about the Trinity and about the resurrection, there we're talking about fundamental affirmations of the faith. When we talk about original sin, we are talking about something that is the underbelly of the church's affirmation. We confess that we believe not in sin, but in the forgiveness of sins. So it would be a horrible thing if we said, you believe in sin. No, I don't believe in sin. That would be like saying, you believe in the devil. The answer to that is, no, I don't believe in the devil. I believe in Jesus Christ. That doesn't mean the devil isn't around. So you don't say, do you believe in sin? No, I don't believe in original sin. But I believe in Jesus Christ who deals with that sin. So when we're talking about sin, I suppose eventually what we're talking about is forgiveness. And in the Apostles' Creed, the only benefit of faith in the triune God that is explicitly stated in the Apostles' Creed is the forgiveness of sin.
Is that just language, or is it that you're using, or is that a credo? You know, I believe in the forgiveness of sin, or I believe in sin. You say, I don't believe in sin, but I believe in Jesus Christ. Is that just a language barrier we have then?
See, I don't even know what that means to say just language, because language
is... Why is it a language barrier? Is it a language?
Behind the language is a reality. The language... So that I think, for instance, when you say, do you believe in the two natures of Christ? I think that the response to that is,
No, I don't believe in the two natures of Christ. I believe in Jesus Christ, who is true God and true man, about whom the doctrine of the two natures has something to say. Believe in means trust in, commit to. And so that in the creed, I mean, it seems to me that's tremendously significant. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, Jesus Christ, the Holy Spirit, the Holy Christian Church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins. That of all of the things that it could have said, sanctification, justification, propitiation, life in Christ, there are adoption as sons, there are a thousand images in the New Testament that could be used for the benefits of Christ. It's kind of interesting that the one that gets its way into the Apostles' Creed is the forgiveness of sins. Hmm? Yeah.
Is this maybe a problem in a lot of us using the word believe in such a way as to say, I accept the fact of, or maybe I believe about, rather than believe.
Classically, there are three components of faith: knowledge, assent, and trust. They have to be handled delicately. There are those who would say faith equals knowledge and assent. Here are 25 sentences. You know those sentences, you accept them as true, and you've got faith. That's one ditch. There's another ditch which says faith is pure trust. No knowledge, no assent. Only trust, no sentences. Down with sentences. Only trust. Trust in what? Huh? Doesn't matter. The great pumpkin, the rainbow, or what? If trust is going to be Christian trust, of course there must be sentences. That's why I say it's not to say generalizations are bad. That's absurd. But it's that we better know what we're doing when we make generalizations. You couldn't do the history of art without words like Renaissance, classical, but it's important to know what those words mean. They are generalizations that gather up data. They're necessary, but the word is not the painting. The word is a word that gathers up, and that's the same with doctrine. Okay? The forgiveness of sins gets its way into the creed. Also, in the Western churches, the forgiveness of sins is a very central confessional item, so that in the Lutheran confessions, for instance, Article 2 of the Augsburg Confession is on original sin. The first article is very, very short. It's on God. There was no issue at the time of the Reformation. We can handle him in two sentences, not because that's all the importance that he has, but because that wasn't the conflict. Article 2, all right, here we go, original sin. And by the time the Reformation develops to the time of the formula of Concord, Article 1 is a rough. We dispense with God completely. That's agreed. No problem. But now, what's the issue? Article 1, original sin. So in the time of the Reformation, it's an exceedingly, exceedingly important doctrine. Also, liturgically, the church in the West is built around the notion of the forgiveness of sins. I don't know how it goes in your particular denomination, but if you go to church in something other than Greek Orthodox or Russian Orthodox church, somehow or another the shape of your worship is such that it begins with the invocation and moves very, very rapidly to the confession of sins and the absolution. Somehow or another, that is a basic fundamental pattern. Don Gregory Dix calls it the shape of the liturgy. So you simply cannot get away from the doctrine of sin, and I would go beyond that. You can't get away from the doctrine of original sin. We ought to admit that that's not a popular word at the time. People talk about guilt. But guilt is something that you can take care of on a therapist's couch. People talk about sickness. You can take care of that with a therapist. Or now people talk about differences, let's say homosexuality, for instance, or just about virtually anything you can imagine, is not only not a sickness. It is simply doing one's own thing. And we have come to the point where there is very little possibility of making any kind of negative judgment on any kind of behavior whatsoever. So sin, and especially original sin, is an extremely unpopular kind of doctrine, and if the church is going to continue to talk that way, it better know what it's talking about. Now, I would like to make a couple of points about original sin, and I'm going to state those simply, and then I'm going to spend some time spelling them out, and we have until 10:15. We can have at least 15 minutes and probably up to a half an hour for conversation. One item on original sin is that the word original is unfortunate. The word means conditional. If we could rewrite all the text and scratch the word original and insert the word conditional, then we would begin to get at what the church has meant by the doctrine of original sin. The doctrine of original sin is not about the origin of the thing, how it got started. The doctrine of original sin says that sin is not only act, but it is condition. Not only do I do sin, but I am sinner. Okay, that's point number one, that original sin means conditional sin, not the origin of sin. The old dogmaticians distinguished between original sin originating, which was the originating process, and original sin originated, which is the present condition. And they said the doctrine has to do with original sin originated, not with original sin originating. Okay, that's point number one. Point number two is that the doctrine of original sin is a description of what the church believes the case to be. It's a word very similar to the word classical in art. The word original sin attempts to gather up the data and to state it in some kind of handleable way. Okay? Now, those are the two points. I'd like to talk a while about sin, and we'll come back to that. I just want you to know where I'm going to come out. Those doesn't have to be mysterious. I'd like to start talking about sin in a rather elemental way, and then just kind of take the thing and turn it around and look at different angles of it. Okay? It's possible to talk about sin as doing bad things, doing wrong things. That's the most elementary kind of way to talk about sin. What is sin? Sin is killing somebody. Sin is kicking someone in the shins. Sin is hollering at my wife at those times when I ought not to holler at her. Sin is doing bad things. Okay, let's work with some medieval psychological distinctions between acting and feeling and thinking. That's dividing man up into three parts, and that's bad, but for purposes of talking, it may be of some use. Okay, sin is not only doing bad things, but sin is also feeling wrong feelings. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, you've heard it said, don't kill, but I say to you, whoever hates his brother. Jesus said, you have heard it said, don't commit adultery, but I say to you, whoever looks at a woman and lusts after her. All right, that's another level. Sin is not only doing bad things, but it's feeling wrong feelings. Beyond that, sin is thinking wrong thoughts. We confess in our church in the confessing of sins, we are by nature sinful and unclean, and we have sinned against thee by thought, word, and deed. So it's wrong, it is sin, not only to do wrong things and to feel wrong feelings, but it is sin to think wrong thoughts. That's, you know, don't knock the intellectual life too hard. Don't knock thinking too hard. Don't knock talking, words, thought, reflection too hard. It's sin to think wrong thoughts. We confess that every Sunday morning. We have sinned against thee by thought, word, and deed, because thinking obviously has something to do with feeling, and it has something to do with doing. Okay, thus far, we're talking about commission. Doing wrong things, feeling wrong feelings, thinking wrong thoughts, those are all commission. There's also the category of omission. So sin becomes not only doing bad things, doing wrong things, but it becomes failing to do right things. Now, there are a lot of people in the church. There are some people in the church. There may be one person in the church somewhere who never gets beyond doing wrong things in his notion of sin. And it's a massive step just to go so far that one recognizes that sin is omission as well as commission. If you pray, and if you confess your sins, think back over the last few nights or mornings or whenever it is that you confess your sin, and try to add up, maybe, the things that you have asked forgiveness for that you have done or felt or thought wrongly, and balance them as over against those things that you have failed to do rightly and failed to feel rightly and failed to think rightly. My guess is, if you're anything like I am, that the commission things come to mind much more quickly than the omission things. Luther, when he talks about the Ten Commandments, says, thou shalt not kill. What does this mean? Well, it means that I should help and befriend my neighbor in his every need. Thou shalt not commit adultery. What does that mean? It means that I should be chaste and pure in all my living. Thou shalt not steal. What does that mean? That means that I should help my neighbor to protect his property and his living. So that one could almost say that sins of omission are much more important and much more drastic than sins of commission. And that is one of the great things about the current theology of hope, Jürgen Moltmann, where the whole Christian thing is centered not around faith, where sin is faithlessness, not around love, where sin is lovelessness, but around hope, where sin is hopelessness. And the sin is to look at a person, a race, a situation, a congregation, a nation, a time, a place, a generation, and say, it's hopeless. Because anything that's hopeless, or that I declare to be hopeless, I don't have to do a thing about. And that's where sin really lies. So that business of omission is terribly important. Sin is omitting to do right things, but sin is also omitting to feel right feelings. Now that's kind of tricky, because a great many of us have the notion that feelings are something over which we have no control. feelings just come. That's why you have to do your own thing. That's why you have to express yourself, because the feelings are there. You have no control over them. Some of you have read Rollo May's remarkable book, Love and Will. And Rollo May talks about love. He uses that word love to gather up what he calls the Freudian era. And Freud tended to say that those feelings are just there and somehow or another have to be dealt with. And Freud tended to say that those feelings are just there and somehow or another have to be dealt with. He goes and uses the word will to refer to a pre-Freudian era, which he calls the Victorian era, where the whole emphasis was on will. I remember being told 1,000 times by my mother, where there's a will, there's a way. Has anyone ever heard that sentence? That means you can do it. That's what made America, I was going to say, great, whatever it is. That's part of the whole Protestant ethic. There was a whole Victorian era that said, you can control your life. Where there's a will, there's a way. After the Victorian era came the Freudian era, which said, that isn't really true. You don't have that much control. You have to recognize that there are vast kinds of subterranean things going on, and that it is simply ridiculous to tell a person who does not have the equipment, the environmental situation, the background, the genes, to do it, to tell him you can do it where there's a will, there's a way. He can't do it. So the Victorian era was followed by the Freudian era, and we're still kind of in that, which says you can't control feelings at all. Rollo May said, yes, you can. And love and will are put together in the title of that book because he can say you can will to love. You can decide to feel one way or another way. That really came home to me in bombastic form when a number of years ago there were a couple of men who wound up in the hospital at the same time and with equally serious problems and for an equally long period of time. The one man I got to visit 2 times, the other man I never got to visit once. I didn't realize until maybe 5 years later what had happened. And what had happened was that inside of me, somehow or another, I conjured up a feeling of love and sympathy for the one man that drove me to his bedside, because this guy was in position to be of some help to me. The other guy was in no position to be of any help to me, and I managed not to conjure up enough love and feeling for him to drag myself to his bedside. I decided, subconsciously perhaps, I decided to feel one way toward one man and one way toward another man. When I go to bed at night, I have to ask forgiveness for omitting to feel compassion, not only for feeling hatred, but for omitting to feel compassion. And the same goes for thinking wrong thoughts and for failing to think right thoughts. How I think about someone or some people. I read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee about a month ago. I would have never formulated it this way before reading that book,
And I guess no one ever asked me the question, and I never put that into words, but I discovered after reading Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee that I thought that this was relatively an uninhabited property when the white man came from Europe. There was a teepee here and there and some guy in a loincloth playing a tom-tom, but essentially it was uninhabited land here, and we just came and moved in and started cooking turkeys and raising corn. Now, that's just a matter of information. I had bad information. I thought wrong thoughts, and those wrong thoughts had all kinds of implications about failing to feel right feelings and about feeling wrong feelings and doing wrong things and failing to do right things toward a whole race of people. So the word sin has to do with doing wrong things and feeling wrong feelings and thinking wrong thoughts and failing to do right things and failing to feel right feelings and failing to think right thoughts. So far, however, we've just been talking about sins in the plural. There's also sin singular. And we say we are by nature sinful and unclean, and we have sinned. So that the word sin is singular as well as plural, and that's where the word original sin comes in. Sin is condition as well as act. Okay, that is a little bit tricky, and we have to go back to Augustine. Every church doctrine is not so much a saying what it is as it is a pointing out of ditches into which the church ought not to fall. It so happens that Augustine experienced in radical form the two classic ditches for the doctrine of sin, and so he hammered out in a classical way the churches talk about sin. The one ditch is Manichaeanism, and that's a word that you ought to know. It's M-A-N-I-C-H-E-A-N-I-S-M, Manichaeanism. There was a fellow by the name of Mani. Had to do with Zoroastrianism, Persian religion, worked its way into North Africa, and Augustine was a member of this Manichaean sect for 12 years. Manichaeanism said that matter, stuff, life, people, creation is essentially and inherently evil. The rock, the body, my toe, the cell, tree, everything that you can taste and touch and feel, the whole empirical world is essentially and inherently evil. That means it is unsavable, it is irredeemable, and salvation means to escape from that evil world. That's Manichaeanism. That has a lot to do with the doctrine of the immortality of the soul that we talked about Wednesday. The doctrine of the immortality of the soul is Manichaean in its relationship to the body. Okay? Now that's one bit. Augustine lived with that for 12 years. He became a Christian, and in the course of his living out of the Christian life, he ran into a fellow by the name of Pelagius. Pelagius was a British monk. Pelagius said that man sins, he does some wrong things, and he may even feel some wrong thoughts, and he may even omit to feel some right feelings, etc. Man sins, but man is not sinful. Pelagius said, sin is act, it is not condition. That means that salvation is largely education, whereas in Manichaeism, salvation is escape from the evil world. In Pelagianism, salvation means education. You have to learn how to do it. You can escape from sin by simply learning how not to do it, less and less and less. And finally, it's very possible to learn not to sin at all, so that you no longer have anything to do with sin. Sin becomes essentially instruction, becomes essentially moral instruction. Karen from Denmark gave me a little poem from Goethe that says, "Man is noble, helpful, and good. That alone is what distinguishes him from all other things that we know about." That's Pelagian. Now, in either case, the Christian faith gets screwed up. The incarnation, the resurrection of the body, the creation of the world, the new heaven and the new earth, the whole business gets screwed up if you go either with Manichaeism or Pelagianism. Augustine found himself in the middle. He found himself aware of both ditches, and Augustine hammered out in classic form the doctrine of original sin. Okay? At the time of the Reformation, the same ditches occur in classic form. On the one hand, in the Roman Catholic Church, which Luther considered to be Pelagian, the Roman Catholic Church taught that original sin was wiped out at baptism. I'm born with original sin, I'm baptized, and original sin is finished. From the time of baptism on, sin is actual, but not conditional. So, how do you deal with actual sin? You deal with it by a system of penance. I did this sin, okay, you do this pilgrimage. I did this sin, all right, that'll be $100. I did this sin, okay, you come to so many masses or novenas or something. So that you can assign a good act to counteract every bad act. Original sin is taken care of by baptism. After baptism, it's all actual. Luther says, the Reformation says, no. Baptism places a life into relationship with God, into the presence of God's grace, into the context of forgiveness, but sin as condition remains. That's why Article 2 in the Augsburg Confession is about original sin. That's why the first article in Formula of Concord is about original sin, because that's what the Reformation was about, that Luther considered the Roman Catholic Church to be Pelagian and its doctrine of sin. But there was also, of course, the tendency to Manichaeism. There was a fellow by the name of Fleischer. He was a later Lutheran guy. And Flacius said, I don't want to get into that Pelagian bag. Pelagianism is bad, and I'm going to back off from that. And in backing off from it, he fell into the Manichaean ditch. And Flacius said, matter, stuff, body, that which I can taste and touch and feel and smell is inherently evil. So the Reformation had to go through the same guarding against those Manichaean and Pelagian ditches as did Augustine. And it comes out in beautiful form in Article 1 on Original Sin in the Formula of Concord with a nice, beautiful little formula. And it's disaster, I think, that we say over and over and over and over and over again about theological talk, well, that's just semantics, or that's just language, or let's not get bogged down in highfalutin terms. It's disaster. Because there are words, there is language, which the church has used to protect distortions of the faith. Why in the world not use them? We use words and language about everything else in the world, but when it comes to Christianity, then we get mad if someone uses a term or a phrase that we haven't heard before. The formula of Concord says that man is essentially, substantially good, accidentally evil, period. It's very simple, huh? Man, the creation, is substantially good, accidentally evil, period. Now, everything is historical, everything is contextual, everything is situational. Those words, too, have a history. They happen to go back to Aristotle, who talked about substance and accident. We're not Aristotelians. We don't use the words in that way. So we have to find out what those words meant. Substance is that without which a thing isn't what it is. You take away a substance, it's no longer what it is. You've destroyed the thing. Accident is something which may thoroughly penetrate something, but which can be taken away, and the thing still is what it is. You take a glass of water out of the tap. Substantially H2O, accidentally, all kinds of crud and bacteria and everything conceivable. If it's water in some kind of decent area, you can let that sit for 10 days and nothing settles to the bottom. It isn't that you can just take a spoon and, you know, take out the junk. It's very much in there, but you can distill that and you get out pure H2O. You don't get out Jack Daniels or something. That glass of water out of the tap is substantially H2O. It's accidentally crud. To say that man and creation is substantially good is to affirm the fact that we and this world are savable. We're redeemable. That's an anti-Manichaean formula, substantially good. To say we're accidentally evil is to say it takes a whale of a lot of doing to get you and me and this world saved. You can't just do it by education or by taking a spoon and taking out that part of me which is bad, or by slipping the soul out of the body or some such thing. It's a massive job that needs doing, but it can be done. And for me, the formula that we need redeeming, but that we are redeemable, says the same thing as the formula substantially good, accidentally evil. Okay? That is what the doctrine of original sin is about. That sin is not just act, but that it's conditioned. Now, there are all kinds of implications about that, and we are really running out of time, and I'm going to say some things very, very rapidly, and then we'll talk. There are moral, there are emotional, there are intellectual implications of taking sin as conditioned seriously. Morally, it means that there is no act that I can do that is not accidentally evil. There is no act that I can do that does not need redeeming. Every single act that I do is tainted by, perverted by, distorted by sin. Nothing, zero possibility for doing a pure act. If I am sinner, every act is a sinful act. That doesn't mean that it's an irredeemable act. That would be Manichaean, but it's a sinful act. feelings. There is no feeling unpenetrated, undistorted by sin. Every single feeling, every emotion of compassion, everything that comes out of my gut is a perverted thing. If sin is really conditioned. Conscience is perverted, distorted, needs redeeming. Head, brain, intellect, words are distorted. I'm a theologian. I ought to pray, and I do often, for forgiveness for my theology. Because my head is screwed on, I hope, some of the time, but it's also very much screwed up because I am sinner. Not only do I do sins, but I am sinful. There is nothing that I can do or feel or think, and that's why it's disaster to trust the gut or the conscience or the brain in any simple, or the behavior in any simple way. There is nothing that I can do or think or feel that is unambiguous. There is nothing that I can do or think or feel that does not require the forgiveness of God. That's one of the implications of what it means to say that I am sinner. Not only do I sin, but I am sinner. All right, thus far, we've been only talking about the individual. We've been talking about sin, and we've been talking about sin, we've been only talking about the individual. Sin is also a corporate category. We are sinful, and we are sinners. Isaiah says, when he sees God, he says, I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. And that was the great contribution of the social gospel movement. It's 100% historically inaccurate to say the social gospel movement forgot about sin. They talked about sin more than anything else. But they talked about sin societally rather than individually. The great contribution of the social gospel movement was to remind the church that sin is a corporate category and not just an individualistic category. Reinhold Niebuhr wrote a book which was really a turning point in American theology entitled Moral Man and Immoral Society. Reinhold Niebuhr knew very, very well that there's no such thing as moral man in a simple way, but he wanted to emphasize the fact that the whole is more than the sum of the parts, and you get a lot of relatively moral individuals together, and you put them in a group, in a complex, in an institution, and there are demonic things that happen when people get together to do a job. Not only individuals are wrong and sinful, but society is sinful. All kinds of implications of that, if you want to begin to spell them out. We saw A Man for All Seasons a couple years late, and is it Thomas More in A Man for All Seasons who says over and over and over again that laws are made by man. There is no law on the books which is unperverted by sin. Arnie Cirilla has a book called The Voice of Illness. He says it's just disaster that we think of illness as something that belongs to individuals. And so when someone gets sick, we extract them from society, which is well. Cirilla says, a sick person is a voice telling us that society is ill, the voice of illness. I was at a psychiatric deal with him, and sitting around with psychiatrists, clinical psychologists, they're talking about their typical patient in this particular hospital, who was a middle-aged woman whose husband had made it, two cars in the garage, traveling all over the world, whatever. And all of a sudden, she goes in the supermarket and screams her head off. She can't take it. And winds up in the psychiatric ward. And we're talking about that. How come all these housewives are screaming their head off in the supermarket? And on. is disintegrating all over the floor in front of the Kellogg's cornflakes. And finally this guy says, maybe the supermarket is sick. Right? There's a German novel came out after the Second World War, talked about the freight trains, boxcars full of Jews going off to be cremated and gassed, people standing on the platform watching that happen. One woman standing on the platform goes berserk and jumps into the boxcar. The soldiers take her by the nape of the neck, pull her out, and put her in an institution for the mentally insane. And the novelist says, in an insane world, madness is health. Who's sick? I think that we're in a time when the corporateness of guilt, there's all kinds of talk about systemic violence, covert as well as overt violence. Who's responsible for shooting Bobby Kennedy and John Kennedy and Martin Luther King? What about corporate guilt? I didn't pull the trigger, but am I guilty? Walter Rauschenbusch, Theology for the Social Gospel, tells about a friend of his in Toronto who was a health officer. This was a long time ago. And his job was to get pure milk into the dairies. And the farmers had a habit of not cleaning their barns, and they'd bring in contaminated milk. He's trying to figure out, what am I going to do about this? So he devised a little scheme whereby he would take a bucket of red paint, put a big X on the cans of the farmer who brought in contaminated milk when he drove his horses and cart back to his farm. Those cans would bounce around, and the neighbors would see those big red X's, and they'd laugh their heads off. Ho, 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 dirty barn, dirty barn. So a guy came in with contaminated milk, took the thing, and put a big X on his cans. He jumped up and down and swore. He got back to his village. The elders kicked him out of the church. Not, says Rauschenbusch, for introducing cow dung into the intestines of the bodies of the babies of Toronto, but for expressing his belief in the damnation of the wicked in a non-theological manner. Rauschenbusch's point is that the church had become so individualistic in its notion of sin that it had forgotten that sin is a corporate category. So that's a whole big thing. Thirdly, sin is individual, that's also corporate. Very quick, it's also cosmic category. The doctrine of sin, the doctrine of sin as condition, the doctrine of original sin says that we live in a very screwed up world. Adam sins, God curses the earth. From now on, you're going to work in the sweat of your brow, you're going to bring forth women in pain. The whole business in the Old Testament has to do with the earth. That's a terribly materialistic, a terribly earthy kind of promise. They look forward to the time when the lion and the lamb will lie down together. They don't now, but they will. When the land will flow with milk and honey. Jesus performs those nature miracles to say, look, I'm fixing up the creation too. It's a mess now. Those storms that come can be calmed. I calm the storm. That's a sign of the cosmic dimension of the redemption of Jesus Christ in this world. We look forward to a new heaven and a new earth. Paul says in Romans 8, the whole creation groans, waiting for the sons of God to come into their own. We live in a very screwed up world. The doctrine of original sin says that we work in this world with God for proximate goals, toward that time when God will get his ultimate job done. The forgiveness of sins allows me to live with myself. It gives me permission to live as sinner. That's what Luther says about simul justus et peccator. At the same time, I am sinner and justified. Salvation does not mean I'm no longer sinner. I am sinner. What it means is I have permission to live with him as sinner. I have permission to live with my wife and my children. We're all sinners. And we sin against one another day after day after day. We believe in the forgiveness of sins. We live in the forgiveness of sins as sinners. And it's also possible for me to live with you and for you to live with me. Not because we're good people, but because we agree to recognize the fact that we're sinners. Dietrich Bonhoeffer says in Life Together, true fellowship in the church rarely occurs because although people in the church have fellowship together as good people, they fail to have fellowship together as sinners. We work for proximate goals. Sometimes that's inch by inch. We have permission to do that because we live in the forgiveness of sins. All kinds of implications of the doctrine of original sin. And it seems to me that it would be disaster if too many people in the church decided that the doctrine of original sin was dispensable or peripheral. It's absolutely essential, I would say, and central for a biblical confession of the name of Jesus Christ. It's a doctrine, it's an intellectual formula, but it does work that has to be done if we're going to be faithful to the apostolic witness of Jesus Christ. Okay, I'm sorry that I took more time than I should have.